In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Coming up is a podcast brought to you by the dedicated and diverse volunteers at 3CR. Just a quick message before you get there. For the month of June, we're asking listeners to donate to the station to help keep us going. We rely on the generous donations of the community to survive. Go to 3cr.org.au/donate and show your support for community-owned and community-run media. Thanks for your support and happy listening.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people on both sides.
And the aliens with mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
Andy, this week we're doing something a little bit different for the podcast version of the show. It was our Radiothon show this week, but it occurred to me that continually reading out the phone number for 3CR and asking people to call up and donate didn't make especially compelling podcasting. And there's things going on in the world of the far right. We might speak to an expert and find out what is going on in the United Kingdom. So this week we are talking to Aaron Winter, the co-author of Reactionary Democracy. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you very much for having me.
Aaron, perhaps we could start with the protests in relation to the Henry Novak case. There's been claims by the far right that there's a system of two-tier policing in the UK. Could you speak a little bit about where that idea comes from? Because the last time I checked, it's not borne out in the reality of policing for black and brown people in the United Kingdom.
No, and it is really a bit shocking but unsurprising that the far right, who has for a long time and almost universally denied institutional and systemic racism, particularly including within the criminal justice system against racialized and migratized people, takes every opportunity to claim it in the case of white people. And it's part of a longer history of two narratives or two tendencies. The first is to take incidents where white people may be harmed or victimized and make it about far-right narratives and far-right politics, reverse racism, two-tier policing in this case, which I can expand upon. But cases which often are examples of injustice and harm and very emotive, and twist them into both their agendas and the mobilization of the far-right and an attempt to mobilize white grievance more broadly. And I guess the second narrative is that of white victimization. And we can see that play out in arguments about two-tier policing, reverse racism, and great replacement. Over the past number of years, we've seen examples of the far right mobilizing on behalf of white victims, predominantly young white girls in the North around the sort of grooming gang scandal. And what they've largely claimed is that it is not only reverse racism, but EDI and anti-racist training within the public services, including policing and social services, and a fear of being accused of racism, which leads them to not pursue, prosecute, or deal with crimes committed by racialized and migratized people. And we've seen that in cases of the grooming gang scandal, but also as a logic or justification for sieges on hotels housing asylum seekers. And it's a complete fallacy that anti-racism training and anti-racism within these institutions, including and particularly the police, which have not dealt with accusations of institutional racism going back decades, are so attuned to racism that they will target white people and accuse white people of crimes. Now, in the case of Henry Novak, who was stabbed, and the perpetrator, who has been convicted and sentenced, claimed that he had been the victim of racism, the police holding down Novak, who said he couldn't breathe and had been stabbed, is seen as an example of the police believing racialized people before they believe white people. And I think we can largely agree that it's a case of really bad practice, really bad training, a lack of safeguarding concerns, and harsh police treatment. But this is something which is disproportionately experienced by racialized people. And the far right don't care about that, because the argument they've made or the narrative they've laid out both fits with their agenda and allows them to get greater attention and mobilize on the streets. One of the other ironies being is that they claim they're doing it in a fight for law and order, and they're attacking the police and they're causing violence. But the other thing is that they have completely disregarded issues within the police, but they've also disregarded the calls from Henry Novak's father that he doesn't want this being used to pursue hate, violence, division. A statement that he made that was quite brave and has not been adhered to by the far right, who always exploits these events. And I don't believe cares about the victims or cares about the issues beyond what they can do to pursue a sort of white victim narrative and a far right agenda. I guess I worry that the mainstream has largely seen this, and mainstream media, mainstream politicians have seen this occur again and again. And instead of condemning them and condemning the racism and condemning the violence, including violence against police from the far right, they've often said these are expressions of legitimate concerns, which has allowed the far right to not only mainstream, but become increasingly emboldened and commit serious violence and serious harms against the communities it targets.
Aaron, one of the things that I thought was somewhat extraordinary and has been remarked upon by many others is, these, to begin with, these sorts of claims aren't new about the supposed prejudice that police display towards whites in their policing actions. But I don't know if it's been the case previously or not to the same degree, where you have government authorities and the world's richest man intervening to support the protests, which have become essentially pogroms. Do you think is this a significant shift in the terrain? So there are street mobilizations and obviously a series of arson attacks, but at the same time, response by authorities has been wanting. There's also determined efforts to mobilize on the basis of these issues, and that seems to have reached a kind of level that perhaps hasn't been witnessed before in the UK.
Yeah, I think there is a significant consolidation of that. I don't think it's totally new. I think what we saw back, and I think it was 2023, when there was an attack, a siege, and I agree with the use of the term pogrom, against a hotel, against asylum seekers in a hotel in Knowsley, Merseyside. You had far-right figures justifying it. But you also, including more sort of leadership, influencers, and elites. But you also had someone like Suella Braverman, who was the Home Secretary at the time, basically expressing understanding for this. And you had a lot of politicians. These wasn't just powerful mainstream far-right figures and icons who might own giant social media platforms, elected and appointed officials in a democratic system going, we understand these. There is a two-tier system. These are expressions of legitimate concerns. And you had that again and again from figures like Suella Braverman, who also just soon within that same year on Armistice Day in November 2023 was referring to the National March for Palestine as hate marches, in ways that allowed Tommy Robinson and his followers and other far-right organizations and figures to rebrand themselves anti-hate marchers. And these are some of the same figures and forces that are then being championed by Trump, Elon Musk, including Musk speaking at far-right rallies. And so what we've seen is a lot of maneuvering from very elite figures, very powerful figures, at different times. It's become almost all-consuming now. But I think it's also the not only the consolidation of the mainstreaming of the far right, it's evidence of where their support, if not funding, comes from. It also puts paid to the idea this is a working class phenomenon. When you have elites riling them up, the activists, and supporting them, potentially funding them, giving them opportunities, and legitimizing them. But one of the interesting things I think about that, one of the other interesting things, is that there doesn't seem to be a really widespread condemnation of these figures. And I think this is linked to the idea that they've justified this as an expression of of class inequality, which I do not believe. But also, and that these are potential voters. This is a market for business. But I think the other thing is that one of the narratives around the mainstreaming of the far right that me and Aurelien have talked about is the way in which you can say, if we don't give space to far right ideas, if we don't pander to them and parrot them in the mainstream, in labor politicians, Tory politicians, media, then they're going to take, the far right's either going to rise in the polls or take to the streets. And now what we have effectively is both. And this has become the dominant politics of our age, whether it is in migration policy and rhetoric amongst elected officials or those actors seeking to be elected, in the media, but also we've seen this in the streets too. So it seems to be that power is not only enabling, it's not only supportive, it's also enabling and complicit even when it denies and condemns individual acts of violence. One of the other issues is that there is a fear of saying this is racism. This is racist violence. This is pogroms. And there's a lot of reasons for this that intersect with the denial of racism and also the weaponization of anti-Semitism and seeking not to evoke the Holocaust and anti-Semitism in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. But it's also, I think, says something about the way in which they've constructed this phenomenon, this community, as a couple of bad apples, but generally an expression of the people or the working class. And it surprises me, because had another community or movement, particularly on the left, particularly made up of racialized people and anti-racist or anti-fascist activists, had such continuous exact cases of violence and extremism and attack the police, I can't, the response, condemnation and legislation and proscription would be off the charts. And right now what we have is that we have a far right who can commit violence against vulnerable people and the police, and they're treated as expressions of legitimate concerns and the demos or the people. And you have National March for Palestine and activists who are seeking an end to genocide, and they're called extremists and supporters of terrorists from day one.
Aaron, there was some reporting in the Byline Times earlier this week about the Tsargrad Society, a Russian neo-Nazi group which has been creating propaganda specifically around the Novak case, some of which has been shared by Tommy Robinson, including while he was in Moscow very recently. I guess it seems obvious to me that there are bad actors who sow discord and are agents of chaos and want to open up fissures within society. But at the same time, I worry that othering the problem might be problematic in itself. I was wondering what your thoughts are when we can see that this is happening, but is it that important?
That's a very good question, and I could not agree more about the othering. I've long resisted the focus on the sort of foreign bad actors and disinformation for a number of reasons. In the same way that I would argue we shouldn't only focus on the far right if it distracts from systemic and mainstream racism, something which is central to my work and my work with Aurelien. But we should also not focus on social media when there's also traditional legacy media doing this sort of scapegoating and mainstreaming. We shouldn't focus on youth when adults are doing it. We shouldn't focus on violence when policy does that violence too. And what I'm finding, or disinformation and misinformation, is a funny one, because I remember around the riots of 2024, people going, the perpetrator of the Southport killings was claimed to be a Muslim asylum seeker, so he wasn't. So the riots were caused by disinformation and misinformation that was likely foreign. And so for two reasons. One is, I go, if he was a Muslim asylum seeker, would that have made the riots okay? How far do we take that misinformation, disinformation line? I also think it's pretty problematic to be blaming foreigners for making Britain anti-foreign. There's something quite ironic about that and quite sick, I think. The other argument was that it was caused by AI and AI and misinformation. And it's almost as if we can't accept there's a problem, and that problem is in the fabric, not just the fringe. But there is no doubt there are bad actors and disinformation and misinformation that come from elsewhere, but also come from here. But if they come from elsewhere, they're also serving the interests of powerful interests here, or powerful figures here in Britain. It's not as if Trump would not be a problem but for Russian disinformation, or Britain doesn't have a really long history of street activism and violence. There was no social media disinformation during the battle for Cable Street or the Battle of Brick Lane. And it's too easy a displacement that belongs in an economy or of other displacements. The displacement, again, of policy to individual or collective races and systemic racism to individualized violence, or the systemic become displaced to the extreme. But I think the other thing is that's interesting about the case you gave is that, going back to my example about how Palestinian solidarity is treated differently than far-right riots and mobilization and violence, even when it's exceptionalized as extremism or violence, is that when there was proscription, it wasn't the far-right that was engaged in pogroms and violence in and against communities and very vulnerable people, but it was against Palestine Action. And then people were arrested for defending Palestine Action, or actually just opposing the proscription. But at the same time as the Palestine Action proscription, the UK government prescribed two far-right organizations. And in case many people would claim, see, they're being fair, there's two versus one. But neither of the far-right organizations was British, and both were engaged in violence. One was Ukrainian and one was Russian. And it was interesting that no one implicated in far-right violence or extremism in Britain that was British was proscribed. And it's because it's partly difficult to compartmentalize and outlaw organizations, movements, and actors that are not only sharing the ideologies, identities, and interests of the mainstream, or what the political establishment is trying to get to vote for them, but they are a valuable constituency. And so it becomes, you implicate yourself and you implicate your potential voters by prescribing them. In the old days, they used to deal with the far right to go, see, this is the exception. Everything else is acceptable. They can't even do that anymore because it's so mainstreamed. And I think a precedent for this was during Brexit, after the MP Joe Cox was murdered by Thomas Mayer, and around that time, they prescribed a far right organization, National Action, which was a sort of like really traditional neo-Nazi kind of violent organization. And I'm not in any way challenging that prescription, but it's interesting that they didn't prescribe anyone who was, you know, pro-Brexit, anti-migrant, anti-Muslim, in a way that would implicate the mainstream or Brexit supporters or the far right that was growing at that time. They exceptionalized one far right group that did not implicate any others. And I think that says a lot about how counter-extremism and counter-terrorism deal with racism and racist organizations, but also how much the power imbalance between the far right and left-wing anti-racist and pro-Palestinian organizations are, because the far right is in bed with the mainstream and defends the system. The others are seen as challenges to them. And after the 2024 riots, the Met had released a statement or quoted in saying, we didn't know this was going to happen with the far right because our eyes were on Just Stop Oil and Palestinian protests. And that was really telling. But then what happened after those riots is they still went after Palestinian solidarity protests, and the far right has run rampant across the country, and it's still being legitimized. And so nothing was learned, in the same way that the far right can mobilize after Southport, after, going back a number of years, Lee Rigby's murder, after Henry Novak, and now what's happening in Belfast after the stabbing of Stephen Ogilvy. And people are watching this happen again and again, and nothing is being done. They still end up being almost democratized.
Aaron, I've read a little but not a lot of commentary on the question of the role of loyalist forces in regards to the events in Belfast recently. And I guess I do have an understanding that loyalism is a long history of collaboration with elements of the far right and, of course, the state. But in terms of the situation in Belfast and Northern Ireland, what do you see playing out there in terms of the political and social forces that are being mobilised in these pogroms? And also, what sources are there that might potentially organise to oppose these groupings and these activities?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that most contexts, the far right that emerges and the way the far right figures in and articulates its politics or mobilizes is informed by the kind of the social, political, historical, cultural contours and conditions of that state or context. And so you can't understand them. You can't necessarily understand them in a way that just generalizes or universalizes. And there is no doubt, sectarianism, a history of colonialism, a history of conflict, and issues of inequality and poverty play into this in Northern Ireland in ways they don't elsewhere, or the way they do differently elsewhere. When we worked on sort of our theories of mainstreaming the far right, we did a sort of comparison with the US, UK, France, I talked Australia a bit, talked about Canada. And some of the theories or concepts and analysis we do is transferable, is useful, but it has to be informed by the kind of the context, conditions, and contours of where we're talking about. And loyalism has, as you note, a history of far right support, engagement, overlap. You could make a similar argument about Scotland and in the way in which Scottish nationalism has been progressive in a lot of ways, whereas the far right was aligned with unionists. And that makes it more complicated and requiring kind of different analysis. But I think we have to also understand that what we're seeing in Belfast and Northern Ireland is also the mainstreaming and the emboldening of the far right and racism, informed by other contexts, other forces, the way in which ideas are travel online and get adapted, get accepted wholesale, or get used in sort of moments of very cynical and very reactionary opportunity. But there's a limit to the sort of the loyalist argument there, because what we're also seeing is people who are not loyalists supporting them. This includes Republicans in the South. You're also seeing the far right in England express support. There's been travel back and forth. And it almost is if the history of loyalism and the far right matters. It isn't the absolute sort of like bar on Republican support, because racism trumps it. And I don't say that definitively or for every individual or actor, but it seems to be right now that the right, part of the reason it's been so successful is because, and this is globally, it's able to put aside what used to be seen as like insurmountable obstacles. This is why you can have a sort of a pseudo women's rights, like femo nationalism on the far right, but also violent misogyny. Or you can see the Christian right and I guess like cultic Odinist fascists aligning. Or you can see Zionists, who some of whom may be Jewish, aligned with the far right in the name of anti-Muslim activism. And I think this is one of the more fundamental changes we're seeing right now. And it's tactical, but it's also existential, or perceived as existential for those on the who are targeted by this. But it's also seen as part and parcel of an existential crisis and opportunity for a lot of far-right actors who buy into the Great Replacement. I think one of the other differences in Northern Ireland, and also I think Ireland as well as Scotland, because we've seen some violent attacks in Glasgow, and Glasgow thought it, or Scotland had seen it, particularly Glasgow, had seen itself as an exception to the far right, which it saw as something that was south of the border. Very similar to the way Canada, my own place of birth, saw itself as an exception because of its neighbors in the south were so much worse. And I think we're seeing Ireland had seen itself, the south had seen itself as an exception as well. And because of the internet, social media, this kind of globalized kind of reactionary far-right politics, Great Replacement theory, and a whole bunch of conspiracy theories, as well as the decades of neoliberal carving away of trade unionism and hope, has really allowed this to grow in places that we thought it wouldn't, or that thought it wouldn't, and growing in ways many were thought it never could, including unity between what are historically conflicting groups.
Aaron, one group which has made great profit out of all of this has been Reform UK. I've noticed that they have been pushing the idea of remigration, which you may have some thoughts on the mainstreaming of this extreme concept. It occurs to me that one reason why groups that push remigration get away with it is because they are not called out on the fact that they are advocating for an inevitably genocidal ethnic cleansing. Could you speak a little bit perhaps about the failure of the media to hold groups like Reform accountable for the things that they propose?
Sure, yeah. I think that's it's a fascinating development, because for a long time, and we argue this in our work, that the far right emerges. We saw this during the Thatcher era as well here. The far right emerges, and then the establishment parties go, oh, they're beyond the pale, but we understand their issues. So we're going to pass these policies in this legislation, and we're going to enforce controls on this group or that group. And then the far right won't get into power and bring something worse. Now, one of the things that occurred in the 2000s is the British. So when Thatcher was doing it, it was with the National Front. And then you have the British National Party, who was trying to get into the mainstream. And each time you have a far right growth, you often have breakaways that think they're not, or organizations that think they're not radical enough, and organizations that emerge that go, we're less extreme than them. And part of Nigel Farage, who leads Reform's longer term strategy, has been to position himself and move between organizations, whether it's UKIP, the Brexit Party, Reform UK. And each time, rebrand effectively the same politics as something more acceptable, but always on the more extreme to the establishment parties, but less not always, but sometimes less extreme than someone else. And he's been always been treated as almost like the opposition leader or prime minister in waiting and the protest against establishment politics. They emerge and then there Musk calls them out as too mainstream, too liberal, or whatever the terms he used were. And then Restore Britain emerges, Rupert Lowe, and they're this sort of the less acceptable face of the far right. And there's a potential for them to split the vote. But Nigel Farage and Reform have seen as being quite good at not only getting into the mainstream, often because the mainstream accepts their narratives and parrots and panders to them. And then something more extreme comes and makes them look better. And so when we had the situation it was the election, 2024 election, Reform got first national election. They got 5 seats, one more than the Greens, but they were still treated as the alternative and the opposition. And that's how the far right has been mainstreamed and has succeeded. And I think it goes back to the fact that the Greens actually are a threat to the status quo in the way that the far right can't be, because they affirm all the same sort of like political, social, historical, economic, cultural kind of interests of the mainstream and the hegemonic kind of interests. But that because of this positioning, concepts they use get pandered to and parroted by the mainstream, and they become part of our language. They become part of our acceptable ideas. And they've done that with like subtle rephrasing of Great Replacement. Remigration in a context where everyone's talking about migration and it's an acceptable thing to oppose. The concept of remigration doesn't sound as scary as it should. But the far right's long, long played with this idea. And going back to the point about like something being more extreme, making something less extreme look better, there was a time when deportation and repatriation was seen as a sort of far-right tropes that we don't go near. Now, deportation and remigration, even to third countries, there was the Rwanda plan that Suella Braverman, who I mentioned earlier, is a big issue, big idea, have become acceptable. And I think one of the issues is that the more we make these far-right and fascist concepts acceptable, how far are we from, we're already in the world of pogroms, how far are we from concentration camps? How far are we from other fascist ideas that we had widely assumed and been told more liberal, moderate versions or less extreme versions were going to keep us from ever getting near? And this keeps on happening. Yeah, I have seen also variations on Great Replacement, as I noted. We had, you had academics saying people were worried they were going to become a minority in their own city. They were worried they were going to be a minority, and they were showing polling about this. Now, a number of these academics who were doing these studies have come out as far right, including running for Reform, Gordon and Denton. But that narrative has consolidated. And it's funny that people still cite this research, even though it's been exposed as false, far right, and because of this, really dangerous. But I don't think we're seeing an end to this. I like how far right ideas have become mainstream, but calling someone far right or racist has become so offensive. This is a sort of quite topsy-turvy world, a world in which two-tier policing can be widely accepted as a reality, one that affects white people and not racialized people. I think that's where we're in. So I don't believe we're in a post-truth era or it's disinformation and misinformation. I think this is really a reversal of reality through the reversal of concepts and the mainstreaming of fascist concepts in ways that feel almost unstoppable at times. And I'm not sure if that answered all aspects of your question, but it's something that I think about a lot as I'm writing and I'm speaking about how we use language. And I'm often amazed at how much my language and my terminology or my description of things may be parsed and debated, but concepts which I know are far right in origin are accepted as it is people's opinion. They do think this should happen. It makes me think back of my PhD, which quite a while ago when I was looking at far right ideas of population management, effectively. So fascist, eugenicist ideas. But one of the ones that was coming out in the late 70s and early 80s in the US was it was called the re-ethnicization of America, where they would, if they couldn't deport people back to countries that they came from, they would move populations around the state to the different states where they would have their own homelands. And it was an idea that it was completely absurd. It was completely racist and fascist, but it's been passed over by the far right with remigration. It's also, it's been repurposed or redone in a way where, no, we're going to take back the entire nation. So this, the reason I'm giving this example is because there was a period of time where the far right had mainstreamed and the more extreme actors had given up hope of ever taking back their country. Now we have the worst of both worlds, where we have the extreme actors and the mainstream aligned about taking back and managing populations in ways that we associate with Nazism.
Aaron, you've pointed to the failings of the various leaderships in the UK and elsewhere in terms of not only failing to address relevant matters, but not even perhaps being prepared to acknowledge them. If that's the case, and if I guess I'm asking outside of these somewhat elite figures or the mainstream political parties and so on, I ask this question also in the knowledge that one of the other responses to the violence in Belfast and similar incidents has been there have been many people expressing profound disquiet, upset, opposition to what's going on, struggling to articulate themselves and to undertake actions that they think will actually begin to address these matters in a more substantive fashion. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas about what are the possibilities for responding that don't rely on being granted permission by party leaderships or other authorities that might begin to tackle these ideas and these movements in a way that affords some kind of hope or possibility of more progressive responses or changes that begin to address these events, both in their particularity but in more general terms.
Yes, I think that's a really good and a really important question and issue. I'm often asked at the end of a talk or an event, now that you've described how terrible things are, can you give us some hope? And I know that's not what you're asking, but I always struggle with this partly because I feel like I am a migrant. I come from a family that experienced fascism and is still affected by it, being a sort of from a Polish Jewish family. But I'm also an academic who has some privileges. And sometimes I feel like hope is needed, but it's not always mine to give because it can come from a place of privilege and safety. Now, I'm not totally privileged and safe, but I can be perceived as such as an academic because of the way people imagine academics or because of actually the safeguards and protections I do have, privileges I do have. But I also work very closely with a lot of campaigners, advocates, activists, NGOs, and I do a lot of public work, public engagement work. And my thinking has developed about that and I've learned a lot. And I'm quite inspired by a lot of that work. I think there is hope in both national, international, and local organizations and activists and actors who work with communities, protect communities, fight the far right, monitor, write, analyze, and develop strategies and good practice to opposing what is going on in the streets, but what is also going on in the political establishment and corridors of power. And I think that gives me hope I don't know that, and there's on the ground and within academia and within the journalism, progressive left-wing and radical journalism, there are disputes about how we do this. I've been at events recently where we talk about radical direct action and other people talk about encouraging community cohesion. And these are not of the same political kind of like currency economy or universe sometimes. But that I think that as much as we do in communities and on the streets and for our students and in the wider public spaces, if politics is only going to parrot and pander to the right, then there is an issue of our rights not being protected, or not just as targets of the far right and state racism, but the right to protest that is being taken away, and such protest is being so actively repressed, it's putting ever more people in danger. And we have to fight that on the streets, in our communities, in our organizations, and on our platforms, but also electorally. And I think I go back to that idea and I don't think things start and end with electoral politics by any means. It's why I moved from political science as an undergrad to sociology. But I think that what happened at the national election, where the Green Party, who was opposing austerity, anti-migrant politics, and genocide, got one less seat as Reform and was treated by the media and political establishment as almost a non-entity and not an alternative, not even as a protest vote, whereas Reform was treated as a protest vote. Then you get to the Gorton and Denton election, and Hannah Spencer beat Matt Goodwin in Reform, beat Labour, and it was done as a protest vote, but also because the Green Party was speaking to people and getting out in communities. We've seen this, both a concerted effort to demonize them and absolutely no change of course by the Labour Party. And that says a lot. That says that there is an absolute unwillingness to listen to the demands of people who should give us hope. And this includes not treating pro-Palestinian solidarity and protests as a democratic demand, but treating the far, engaging in pogroms as the legitimate concerns and demands of ordinary people. And that is really scary. But I think we have to continue to take action, engage, but also really, I think, lift up and remind people of the forms of activism and campaigning that will give them hope, particularly those people who are at the sharp end, who might feel that no one cares, because they're not only are their rights and their democratic demands, but their existence is being treated at best as collateral damage for political calculations that see all the value in the and all the power in the far right. And I think that really needs to change. And I think we need that from the media as well. The media, largely the same as politics, has been legitimizing the far right and these kind of narratives and treating the migratized and racialized communities as if they don't, and the left, as if they don't matter, don't exist. They're not consuming that media. But I think the other thing is, and I want to just take it back to, while I am an academic, which is my paid job, and I teach and I publish in journals and stuff like that, I also feel it's really important to be in the public sphere and be in engaging with the public and working with communities and organizations. But one of the things that I really want to highlight, and because I don't believe there's this divide between academics and activists, or academics and people in the real world or whatnot, but that. And I see this as someone who's in a community that had raised the colors everywhere, the flags everywhere, including on the roads, the zebra crossings, little shops. But that a lot of what's happened has not just been mainstreaming of the far right by politicians and the media, but by some of those academics who I spoke about. And that is academics in political science and politics who claim this is the legitimate concerns of the white working class, so we have to listen to them. where these are elites saying this in their own interest, but also academics within the counter-extremism, counter-terrorism space who have managed to help exceptionalize racism as a sort of as a fascist or extremist thing that can be countered by a state that we should trust to fight racism for us using the same tools, counter-extremism and counter-terrorism tools, which have disproportionately securitized, targeted Muslims and legitimized the far right. And so as an academic, I feel like I need to stand up and I need to counter that as well. And I think there is an hope in a lot of the people I meet at events and at protests and in community meetings. And I do think we have to amplify those. And we have to get the media and politicians and academics who often center white grievances over the experiences of those targeted in the name of those white grievances. I think we need to amplify and we need to have hope in these voices.
Well, Aaron, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on. If people want to read more of your work, they can find you on Blue Sky at aaronwinter.bsky.social. And Andy, just before we go, I'll say again, if podcasts like this help you further your understanding of the fascist threat, perhaps consider making a donation to the 3CR Radiothon. You can go to 3cr.org.au/donate and chuck us a few bucks to help us keep producing radio like this.
Yes, we'd very much appreciate it. And thank you so much, Aaron, for being our guest.
Thank you very much. And I should say this podcast and your work is some of that, which I think is really important and does give hope.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
This June, we'll be asking for your donations to support 3CR.
Your donation during Radiothon keeps the station radical and enables us to give voice to our community for another year.
All donations over $2 are tax deductible.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au. Show your support by donating this June.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.